This episode of Inspiration Point is brought to you by the Quests and Chaos Podcast Network and the generous patrons over on patreon.com/inspirationpoint. So we'd like to give a big shout out to
Garlic Bread, Eric, and Spike.
And at our Muse $20 level, we'd like to thank
Prostaskius, Leroy, Kate, Jeremy, Jenna, Jacob, Falangor, Cheryl, A Bad Idea, Red Dead Coquette, and Robert Hans.
Thank you for helping us bring a little inspiration out into the world. And now, on with the show. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Inspiration Point. I'm Adam, and of course, I'm joined with Tiana. Hello.
Hello. How are you, my friend?
Oh, I'm very good. Very good. Got my coffee this morning. I'm on my second Spindrift, and I am in a quiet room away from my children.
Sometimes you gotta do that. You gotta, like, take that break and just reset and refocus and come and talk about TTRPGs in a dark room.
They also like it when I'm not around sometimes, too, right? Like, not too much, but, like, definitely they're like, okay, now I can do whatever I want for a few minutes. So, anyway, it's a win-win scenario, and that's what we're trying to do here. I spent too much money at the Ren Fair, I gotta tell you. I was so good. I didn't spend a dime, and I was just killing it. And then you know what I did? I bought a pauldron.
Oh, yeah.
I bought a leather pauldron that had, like, different layers and sections, and it folds beautifully. And it's, like, just the perfect color for my outfit. Dang it.
I understand entirely. The last time that I went to a Ren Fair was not last year, but the year before, I think. Was it? Yeah, it must have been. Because I listened to Black God's Kiss, the audiobook, on the drive down to there.
Is that how you measure time, is through sections in audiobooks?
Partially sections in audiobooks, but also what was I listening to when? So that tells me, like, when in my, like, time frame was that?
Yeah, that makes sense.
So it couldn't have been last year because we had finished Blood and Thunder, which was pretty heavily influenced by Black God's Kiss.
Yeah. I can't separate time at all. Like, it's all mush now.
Time blindness is such a thing, especially after COVID. But the last time that I was there, I got a leather mask, and it's one of the really nice leather masks. And that was the only, like, big purchase that I made all day, but it was like $300 for this really nice, like, beautifully intricate, layered green man kind of horned god of the forest kind of mask.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, I'll send you a picture later. It was my profile picture for a little while, yeah. And I love that mask. I need to use it again.
You became Sylvanas.
Basically, yeah.
Like, I will become Oakfather.
There's even a picture of me, like, sitting in a fairy grove with my hands, like, folded under my chin, wearing the mask, just staring at the camera.
I bought my daughter a little, like, it just covers the eyes, really. Kind of like half mask, and it had, like, a steampunk vibe. Yeah, she definitely enjoyed that.
I'll bet.
I keep seeing these Oni masks, and I want to commit cultural appropriation so bad. You know what I mean? Like, I just want one, man. They're so cool, man. Oni masks are, like, the coolest thing ever.
They're very neat, and such a rich history behind them.
Absolutely. It's just like, every time I play a paladin, with the exception of Roland, like, they become a samurai at some point, right? Like, it has to happen.
I mean, in fairness, Roland didn't start as a paladin. He started off as
a bard. You know,
as a hoity-toity British bard. It would have been very strange for him to go from that to a samurai paladin.
To a samurai, yeah. He went to, like, kind of a knight in lighter armor.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it was, with my half-orc paladin, like, I went straight up from, like, barbarian vibe, like, Frazetta painting character to straight up samurai, like, including a mask and everything else. Like,
oh, it, wonderful.
He had this Gith Yankee greatsword. And of course, I was always, you know, sheathing it and unsheathing it to get those that vibe out. And it, you know, with a half orc, it was easy because he's like, you already have Oni mask going on, right?
Basically, you're already like the monster, heavy quotes.
Yeah, so that was super cool. And then every time I play like Skyrim, you know, they definitely code the orcs as like the samurai race, essentially.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I don't know if you've noticed that, but like their armor style is very Eastern. Their swords are single edged.
That would require me to actually play Skyrim beyond like trying to find my way out of things. That's a bold assumption, Cotton.
Speaking of Roland, I've also been doing a Gale playthrough.
Ooh.
And been doing that on Honor, of course. And finished. Well, I can't say I finished Act 1 because the Underdark is still technically Act 1. But I'm level 5 and carefully plotting my way through. But I've done everything prior to it. And it's been really cool trying out different things from a pre-generated character's perspective.
Sure.
And getting their angle on the story. So it's just, there's so much good replay value. And that's what I really love about a good game is a lot of replay value. Just ironic because we really can't get that much from a TTRPG, right? It's a one and done. Like, I've designed campaigns and campaign worlds in the past with the thought that I'm going to go back in with different groups and we're going to play this from different angles. Like,
sure.
Maybe even doing the same story, just with a completely different party and just seeing where it goes. And it's interesting, but I have noticed that I don't enjoy rehashing, right? I want to start again and start again and start again all the time.
Yeah, I think the TTRPGs are unique in that a lot of the experience that you get comes from not just like the plot points and the side quests and whatnot, which is very much like the video game experience.
Right.
But the people that you played with, the character that you played as, it is very much every game of a TTRPG is lightning in a bottle. And
it really is, yeah.
You can't recapture that.
No, you really can't. And, you know, I'm still looking for a certain kind of magic, as I think that a lot of sort of career GMs do, you know, where they're looking to be as entertained as a player as when they're GMing, and that's a tall order.
That's very hard to do. I mean, I'm lucky enough that I am more of a player than a GM, so I can disengage that to an extent, mm-hmm. because I've played far more than I've GM'd.
Yeah, and I've played more than I sometimes act, but like how many campaigns have I actually completed? That's a different story, right? Like, and I think most people out there would say, yeah, most of the campaigns I've played have not reached a satisfying conclusion.
Or any conclusion at all, really,
right,
besides
right.
just like everyone disappeared off the planet. I was talking to my friend Catherine because I brought her into her and her fiance into their first like full length campaign, and it actually finished. And she was talking about that she's an actual like aerospace engineer, you know. Casually aerospace engineer playing D&D.
Just
why
big,
not?
Big freaking brain.
Oh, she's great. She played a life cleric, which was very fun to watch her experience.
Mm-hmm.
But she was talking about it with some of her coworkers, and all of them were like, wait, your very first campaign, and you finished the story. And you not only finished the story, because we were playing Descent into Avernus, but you finished the downloadable content that your GM made up for you to continue the story. And you all hit, like, I don't think we hit 20th level, but we were very high level by the time we finished.
Yeah.
Their minds were just blown by that, because it's like, that doesn't happen.
Right. No, it's extremely rare. It's extremely rare. And I think that a lot of that is the game design itself. Like, I hope that within future editions, they learn to make more out of that leveling process.
Yeah.
Because it's honestly just too slow, right? You frankly just don't get enough XP.
Yeah.
And part of the reason why Wrath became doable was because I was giving you guys the adjusted XP for the encounter, not the actual flat encounter value.
Yeah. Right?
So for those of you that aren't familiar with that, the way that fifth edition tries to balance, these encounters is whenever you add a character at a certain number, the XP value of the encounter multiplies. But that's not the XP the players get.
Mm-hmm.
That's just to inform you as the GM how much, how difficult it is. And so, I got rid of that and basically just said, if the encounter is this hard, you should be able to earn it all, right? That makes sense to me. And I was upfront about what I was doing, and everyone was like, yeah, sounds good to me. I like leveling up.
Yeah.
That really helped out a lot. And it still took us a while to get to 20, but we did it.
Yeah, it still took us 2 years?
Yeah, about 2 years, you know. And mind you, that's playing once every other week with cancellations and, you know, things like that that happen. But, we played pretty consistently, and then we got through it. And those sessions were about, 3 to 4 hours at a time.
Because we're old and want to go to bed at a reasonable time.
Yes, we are. Like, every time it's about 10:30, I could tell everyone's like, uh-huh, yeah,
yep,
cool.
Yep.
And then I'm like, all right, and we'll find out next time. And everyone was like, good.
There have been a couple of times where you've said, and we'll find out next time, where everyone's like, no!
Right.
We want to keep going now.
Well, you got to have that hook in there. But, but at the same time, I'm like, okay, do you want to really stay up for half an hour? And they're like, not really.
Yeah, because there's very much the we want to know what happens next. But also, as Kate has said, 3:30 in the morning comes very early.
Yeah. And, Leroy's always exhausted from saving the universe. And, yeah, everybody's, super tuckered out. So, which is good. You know, back in the days when Andrew and I were in college together, 8-10 hour sessions, no problem,
Jeez. I can't even imagine that even when I was younger. Like, the closest equivalent, I think, was when I really got into Persona 3 for the first time. And I was playing it for just hours on end, but it didn't require any brain power because so much of that is grinding.
Well, especially in Persona, you're just hitting X. Like, there's only one button in that game.
Basically. Persona 3 Reload has actually kind of solved that a little bit because I use the controller on Steam on my computer.
Oh, yeah? Is that better?
I prefer it because I've always played Persona games with a controller.
Well, it's just the dialogue, especially in those intros. And,
God.
As much as I love the Persona titles, the latest three have all had that same problem of...
It takes 4 hours to get through the tutorial level.
Correct. Yeah. And it's finally you can play now, right? And then it's a great experience. So you go, okay, it was worth it. But man, that start, you think the carriage ride in Skyrim is bad.
Yeah.
It's this is so much more intense. But at least they are dropping a lot of hints and they're telling you a lot of information that you'll only understand on your next playthrough.
There's a lot of story that's happening at you in the first 4 hours, but there's, for me at least, enough interest in what is happening at me that I want to dig in and find out more.
Speaking of finding out more, let's go ahead and continue with our document. We're about 15 minutes in almost from faffing about. So what we've been doing the last couple of episodes is going through this campaign document that I've put together for my classes in hopes that it can help blossoming GMs find the confidence to build a campaign. Because when you first look at, I'm going to make a campaign for a group, that can be a very daunting idea, and it can be difficult to even know where to start. And frankly, the Dungeon Master's Guide does a pretty good job of setting this up, but, it's still a big, thick book, right? And that is also very daunting. This document is, 10 pages, 15 pages, 14 pages. Which is still a lot, but mind you that a lot of that is inserting charts. Pictures and doing charts and you know, things like that. So it's not like you must write a 14-page essay in order to
single
play Dungeons.
Single-spaced, 12 font.
Right, yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah, that's not what we're saying. So what we're just trying to provide structure. And, of course, like, a lot of GMs out there have provided different structures that they like to use. This is just what I'm working with right now. Because it needs to be long enough, but it also needs to be short enough.
Mm-hmm.
And it needs to be short enough so that you don't burn out, right? Because that's the big thing. There has to be enough there for you to have substance, but you also need to have as little there so as to create surprise for yourself.
Mm.
And so, like, it is a delicate balance that you must try to achieve. So we've gone through the simple things such as campaign theme.
Yes, so simple. Theme. The thing that your campaign is about is absolutely the easiest thing to come up with.
You know, even as I was saying it, I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, no, you were just waiting for me to be like, my guy.
My guy. This...
My dude.
Okay, so yeah, the theme is what your story is about, and that's not necessarily the easiest thing, but it is so integral, and it is so important, right? So you have to know that in order to make your synopsis and your plot feel like interesting things, right? If you've ever explained your character or your campaign to somebody and their eyes glazed over, the reason that that happened was because you were saying plot to them.
Yeah.
And nobody cares, okay?
Depends on how you do it, but yes, usually.
Usually that's the case. We also go over the core assumptions. What are the rules of this universe? Of this world that we live in, what do people know? We also talked about the religion, politics, and economic situation of that. Again, that sounds very scary. We're looking for a paragraph per thing, right? Broad strokes. You're going to hear me say that a lot. You've heard me say that a lot. But it's so important to not over-detail these things, as enticing as that might be. Because you're not writing a book that you're trying to publish, right? Like, you don't have to think, oh, this needs to be a 150-page document.
Right.
And then it's legitimate. It's like, no, don't do that. Because you're going to get to page 40 and you'll never touch it again, right? I should know. I've done that enough times.
There's a reason why when I do writing projects, it tends to be NaNoWriMo, where I'm looking at the word count, not the page count.
Yeah. And that's, yeah. Well, anyway, the the next thing I have you go over are the player characters and making sure that you are charting out the most important things about the player characters and that they are fresh and present in your mind so that as you develop your story, you remember who it's about. Mm-hmm. We have to know what it's about. We have to know who it's about, right? If we lose sight of those things, again, we get plotty and boring. Okay. Then we went over the main settlement. What is our central town? Who are the people in it? What is the cast of characters there that we're really going to care about? We'll go more into those characters later. We then talked about the three-act structure for creating a plot line once you have all of those pieces in place. And then I have a flowchart, a visual flowchart of how the campaign is organized by the gameplay elements, which is to say, in Act 1, we have a dungeon. In Act 2, we've got a couple of dungeons. In Act 3, we have one last dungeon, right? Dungeon being, again, used loosely as a term for the place where the adventure happens. Okay, the adventure location, as the DMG would put it. So at that point, we're caught up. And if you want to hear more about what we covered in those are the past two episodes. All right. So are we good to go? Are we good to move forward?
I think so. And it looks like the next section is getting into the nitty gritty, as we said last time, and diving into things like, I think the first one is the random encounter table.
That's correct. Yeah. So I have a random encounter table. And, you know, again, I'm going to say random in quotes here. You have to make sure that everything on your table is relevant to the story. It's going to build a sense of environment of the world that is lived in. It's going to support those core assumptions that we talked about earlier on. It's going to help enhance that immersive experience. I don't have a hard and fast rule about when to employ a random encounter other than you'll know when you need it.
It's by vibes, man. It's not a prescriptive thing.
Correct. No, that's absolutely correct. So I have set up a little table here in the document that creates some varying rarity. So it's not like every five something happens. Because like if you roll a 100, you expect something like really interesting to happen,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, you expect like a dragon to fall out of the sky at you, out of the clear blue sky.
Yeah, so some things have like a 5% chance to happen. Some things have like a 3% or 1% or 10%. You can change these numbers and vary them however you want. Some people prefer to just do a D20 thing. I like to have the D100 because it's fun to do, and it gives me lots of options for different things. Then I have basically the encounter information on the next column where it's like, okay, what's the challenge rating and what are the monsters involved? Like, what are the assets that are needed in order to pull this off? So in my first example, of course, is goblin. So I just say 4x goblin, 200 XP, right?
Goblins are, you know, the meat and potatoes of the beginning.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the next column over is the scenario. So this is giving a little bit more information, like why 4 goblins? What are they doing? You know, so I've just wrote something simple. A gang of goblins demands travelers pay protection fees. And I think that's about as detailed as it needs to be. The rest of it, you can improvise.
Yeah.
If you bog this down with lots of information, then when you reference it, the length of text will tire your brain.
Yep.
So don't do that.
I just love that it's the teacher over here being like, make this as simple as possible, streamline it, find the exact right words, don't give me a whole bunch of chaff. I love
it. Yeah, no chaff. That's a good word. The wheat and the tares.
Yeah. Right?
That's exactly what I mean, because students really struggle with this. They really struggle with the teacher when the teacher says, write less.
Yeah.
They don't know what that means because like most assignments that are in academia are like word count.
Yeah.
Right? They're word count, page count, typeface, all that stuff. We want that MLA format so that we know that you're putting in X amount of work.
Yeah.
And so the idea becomes, oh, this is about work. It's about effort. It's about sweat.
And not about what's being said.
And it's like, okay, I'm going to have you write a lot, but a lot of little things.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, so that's the random encounter table. This is one place where I give Storm King's Thunder like tons of credit. I think that they made like just an absolute gold standard random encounter table. It's where most of the fun of the game is.
It really was.
Because the actual dungeons kind of suck.
True.
They're way too big. They're way too complicated. Like, and by big, I mean not like lengthy. I mean, everything's made for giants. And so your map won't load on roll 20.
Yep. That was always so hilarious for Flair being not just small as like someone who found out that she was a discarded fire giant, but being small for a humanoid because I play small characters. She was like 5 foot even.
Mm-hmm.
So like she came up to people's knees most of the time, it felt like.
Yeah, mid-shin in a lot of cases. So anyway, highly recommend that. That one also splits it up by environment. Because that whole campaign is like, okay, your players are mostly going to be exploring.
Mm-hmm.
So the table actually works in more columns that have to do with what environment you're in. So if you want to go into more detail, that's a really good example. What I have here is just one table.
Yeah, and we also have a full podcast episode talking about random encounter tables. So if that's something that you want to dig in deeper to, go back and listen to that because we had a really good discussion about random encounter tables, and I had my mind changed. I have never liked random encounter tables because it's like, a fight for the sake of a fight, and I hate those.
Right.
But if I think of it not as a series of fights, but as a series of encounters.
Correct.
Which
correct.
It's there in the name, but like you look at all of them and it's like, oh, here's a fight, here's a fight, here's a fight. And then I start looking at other ones. It's like, oh, no, here's a wandering knight who may be able to give you information. Here's a group correct. Of refugees that really underlines the horrificness of the Civil War. Like, that really helped change my mind about it.
You know, they have random encounters in Dragon Age Origins.
They do. I've run into quite a few of them.
Right. When you're traveling, you get interrupted. And not all of them are combat. A lot of them are wandering trader.
Yeah.
Or guy you can talk to, you know, it's...
Or Zevran.
Or Zevran, right? Some of them are prescribed, like, okay, at this point, Zevran shows up. But, like, you know, there's one where you basically find where Superman crashed.
Yes! I'm really excited about that one, because I get star metal to make a cool sword.
Yeah, you get the star metal from it, and they have the Martha Kent, you know, sort of Easter egg, and that's it. But yeah, I mean, that's cool, right? I love that stuff.
It is. And it's those random little moments that really remind you of like what the, because like, it's so easy to get bogged down in just like, this is the quest, this is the thing that I must do, and forget what the rest of the world is. Things are still happening in the world, even if you're not there.
So true. Okay, so after the random encounter table, we get into the actual dungeons. And this is where it gets tough, right? Because the game is called Dungeons & Dragons, so thou shalt have these things, right? A dungeon, again, doesn't need to be a dungeon. Your dungeon, in quotes, could be a route through some trees, right? Mm-hmm. It could be the Mines of Moria, right? It could be... you know, an arena with a gauntlet of enemies. Right? Yeah. There's lots of possibilities. It could be a manor house that you're infiltrating.
Yeah, it could be a tavern that you're working your way through to go talk to the Thief King. It could be, like, there's a whole slew of things that it could be.
But here's where I'm saying, yeah, do work. Because you should draw a map, whether that be, you know, with pen on grid paper, or using like Incarnate, like I like to use, or Campaign Cartographer, or whatever you want to do, you know, but draw something. Make sure you have a plan. Make sure that these dungeons have the fare that people are looking for. They're looking for things to discover. They're looking for treasure, of course, but they're also looking for information. Mm-hmm. They're looking for foreshadowing. They're looking for hidden entrances. They're looking for secrets. They're looking for even traps to a degree.
Yeah.
Depending on your players, maybe they want puzzles. This is a good place to have some degree of policy. Yeah, I know. I'm the same way. Right. I like nothing frustrates me more than puzzles, especially if my character's supposed to be intelligent.
Yeah.
Because I don't feel that intelligent, so I'm like. But anyway, have that populated with encounters. Within that dungeon, this is separate from the random encounters, of course. So that they need to be succinct. Everything that exists in that dungeon needs to be on theme. It needs to be part of that story. It shouldn't feel like I walked into a room and I fought three spiders because D&D demands it, right?
Right.
We don't want that. If there are spiders there, let's have a good reason why they are there, right? Let's make that interesting. Let's make sure that that ties in with the villain's plot or something, right? Or maybe this is a consequence of having meddled in some other problem, right? So that's where I have like dungeon one, give me some basic information up top, and then I actually have you paste in the map into the document, right? And then I have a dungeon key at the bottom that talks about, well, like if you number your dungeon, like you number the different rooms, you're going to want that to reference somewhere.
Yeah.
On Roll 20, I really enjoy this. I have on the GM layer a bunch of tooltips. So I don't even have to open things up. I can just scroll my mouse around. And I can see all my little invisible buttons.
Oh, that's cool.
And when I hover them, it tells me the little thing I need to know. And what's great about that is they have character limits. And so I am forced.
It forces you to streamline.
It forces me to streamline, which I'm grateful for in the moment that I'm running, because I don't want to sit there and go, hold on, guys, I need to read a paragraph really fast.
I need to remember what I wrote. Crap.
Yeah, so I really love knowing that stuff. So again, when it comes to your dungeon key, brief, succinct, efficient, right? And then I have you make several dungeons in the same way, right? Yeah. And I think it's important to have a certain number of dungeons up front and built, because you don't want the trap that I often fall into is we go through the adventure, it leads someplace, and then I decide I want to make that place, right? And then I make another place, and then I make another place. And the next thing you know, we've done 20 dungeons, right? Yeah. And I'm like dying, right? I recommend 4 at the minimum, because you should have 1 for Act 1, at 1 for Act 3, and 2 for Act 2.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to put more in Act 2, you can.
Yeah.
So I would say your campaign should have, unless your whole campaign is one mega dungeon, right? Like if you're doing Tomb of Annihilation, you only need the one dungeon.
Or Dungeon of the Mad, Dungeon of the Mad.
But now you're building layers instead of separate dungeons, right? So that's a different animal in that case. But like if you're doing like a more of a sprawling campaign, like I like to do, because I do find that players get bored when they're in the same environment for too long.
Yep.
See Dragon Age 2. For reference, right?
I'll argue with that, but okay, sure.
Well, especially since they reused the same assets.
I love Dragon Age 2 because I felt like I really got to know the city.
Right, you do really get to know that city, but the city environs were pretty lackluster, in my opinion, for the most part.
I guess.
I had issues with the encounters, but man, I love the character animations. and the art style. Those were beautiful. I could hang out with the Aerishock all day.
Man.
So that's how I break down dungeons. Do you have anything to add to what we have for dungeons?
Not really. I think you broke that down fairly comprehensively. And this has definitely been on my mind lately because I'm running Phandelver and Below, and I just finished with Wave Echo Cave with my players. And I had a lot of the frustrations of, why is this here? There's a mishmash of things that it's like, oh, it's a cave in D&D, so there's an ochre jelly here somewhere, or this and this and this. And I'm like, this has nothing to do with the story. Why is this here?
No, yeah, absolutely. That's actually another place where Storm Kings tends to do well, is they're like, yes, there's a black pudding here, but here's why.
Yeah.
And that was kind of nice. Like, it definitely felt like a lived-in ecosystem. Again, it's just... however, the building is made too big. Right. But but it was really, it did really well on that. And you want to make sure that everything has flavor and intent. Intent is just so important. And again, don't forget about that theme. So when I was talking about Wrath of the Scorned and the theme being love, like what is love? And yeah, baby, don't hurt me no more. Right. But even that part was like actually relevant. Right. So the area for the white dragons, it was about Zeus forcing his selfish love onto the unwilling. Right. And Artemis protecting people from that. Right. And so that was like the very obvious. This is bad. This is toxic. This is why we hate Zeus. Right. The green dragon area was everything is meat. Everything is devoid of meaning. Love is completely unnecessary, right? The blue dragons were more about like familial love over everything else. As long it's sort of like Joffrey and Cersei. Like, yes, my child is a monster, but he's my child.
Yeah.
Right? That sort of like dark familial love. And like the red dragons, it's all about service to the patriarch, the matriarch, whoever it is. It's all about the family name, the title, that sort of thing.
And expectations and making sure that you fall in line with what is expected of your name.
That, yeah, absolutely true. And then we kind of skipped the Black Dragons. Like they basically got a cameo, but at that point I was like, everyone's tired. We need to wrap this up. So Black Dragons didn't really get much of a chapter. They got kind of a cameo. But we did go to the underworld, and the underworld had love is something that we want to desperately hold on to, even if it kills us, right? Yeah. Like, that was really more about you than it anybody was. Else, because your character had a long-lost love who was stuck in the underworld, and mm-hmm. Hades was using that against you. And the idea was, you know, well, what you ended up deciding was that sometimes in love we let go.
Yeah. And I think for Zeph, that was very important for them to, because like their whole life had been defined by that event and the pain and the horror of that, and being around her new friends and claiming her independence again, being able to say, yes, this bad thing happened to me, but
mm-hmm.
that was yeah. pretty important. And it was cool to go through that journey, even if it involved dying first.
And that went along with the layer of the fates, where it was love is something you can control and should, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well, maybe not.
Yeah.
Maybe it's absolutely something we can't control, and maybe we shouldn't even.
Because if you control it, you kill it.
Right. And by trying to guarantee certain outcomes, we doom it, right? Like, when you guys came back from the underworld, it was because the children had been eating the flesh of the fallen fates. And had been becoming fates as a result.
Ugh.
And then when you guys came back, you guys were like, stop it. Stop doing that. That's bad. Okay?
That's real bad.
But what if you can't come back? Then we don't come back. You know, like, that's okay. So again, more of that sort of letting go. And then when you guys went to heaven, it was like, okay, here's a good example of love. But also, let's not forget that love isn't about escaping, but there's duty involved as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that there's a certain responsibility in it. And then all of that informed going to deal with Hephaestus and Ares. You know, Ares was just the love of the self.
Yeah.
Or the love of carnage, the love of the carnal, let's say.
Yeah.
And getting rid of him. And then, of course, finally delivering that final message to Hephaestus. And that was the thing, like, you know, without too much prompting, you know, it was, you know, everybody's like, we're not going to kill Hephaestus. Like, that was just like not even in your minds.
No.
You know,
he'd been our friend for so long at that point. Like, we would not have gotten anywhere near where we were without him.
Right. Right. But everyone could also see that he was wrong about things. They could see that he was damaged.
Mm-hmm.
They could see why he was damaged. And everybody had a lot of compassion and empathy for him.
Yeah.
And that led to the most satisfying conclusion possible.
Yeah. And Ares and Hephaestus were both very much examples of a very selfish kind of love, where it's like, I don't want love for the sake of the love of this person. I want it because it's mine. I'm going to take this and claim this, and I don't want anyone else to touch it. And the difference there between Ares and Hephaestus is that Hephaestus was able to stop and listen, and that mm-hmm. was what ultimately saved him.
Yeah, it was. And you know, I hope that the emotion came through okay through the mic without a camera. I was really trying to nail it with him, because that was like, that was the part that mattered the most.
It
right?
did.
So I know the last couple of episodes have just been theme, 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 but it's so important, guys. Like, I just can't understate it.
Yeah, if you don't know what your story is about, then you don't have the skeleton to build everything off of. Everything is then just a loose collection of parts that is like, well, this is fun to do, and this is fun to do, and this is fun to do, but it doesn't mean anything. And if it doesn't Correct. Mean anything, then it's very hard for players to connect emotionally to it, which, I mean, you know, if people want to just like run around and hit things, that's fine. I am not going to diss on, I'm not going to yuck anyone's yum. Have fun with that if that's what you want to do, but that's not why I play TTRPGs. I'm here for the feels.
You know, and as Andrew would say, you know, there's video games, man, so why aren't you doing that? Like, go play Helldivers with your
exactly.
buddies, right? That's what, you will probably enjoy that more because you will get to play. No one has to be the GM.
Yeah.
Right. So, but, you know, again, you do you or play Warhammer. Right. Like, why not just play Warhammer? Oh, yeah, because money. That's why.
Oh, my gosh. That hobby. Like, you think D&D's expensive. Jeez.
Yeah, dude. I think that was a big reason. I think originally I did want to get into Warhammer because I just fell in love with the art. But it was like fantasy Warhammer. And then like fantasy Warhammer kind of disappeared. And my dad just wouldn't flip the bill for it. And so D&D, here we come, right?
D&D, because like, I mean, you can play Warhammer with a sheet of grid paper and a couple of books. You can, but most people won't. Whereas with D&D, like a lot of people will play that with just a sheet of paper and maybe some coins as tokens.
Oh, yeah. You can absolutely rough it in D&D far more because that theater of the mind can really take you a lot further.
Mm-hmm.
Warhammer's a different game. It's a different game.
I haven't gotten to play it. I've played a scenario of Warhammer that was brought over into Call of Cthulhu, which was very bizarre.
That doesn't seem like that goes together at all.
It worked shockingly well because it was this sense of like helplessness and nihilism that actually works pretty well in Call of Cthulhu. Hmm.
Also works well in 40K, come to think of it.
Yep, that's kind of the thing.
Those sort of nihilistic universes.
Mm-hmm.
Which, yeah. Okay, the last part of the document, we're already at the end.
Look at us.
Only three episodes. is your cast of characters, okay? And here I provide one completed example of an NPC that you can have. And I told my students, you guys can delete her and you can replace her with
no one does, do they?
Yeah, almost all of them just kept her right there. So I have this character named Brunhilde. And I have a little picture I stole from Pinterest to show her off. And mm-hmm. then her role, the NPC role being what is their function in regards to the party.
Mm-hmm.
And so in her case, she's a patron. She's the one, she's your quest giver. She's the one that helps give you the stuff you need for the quest to happen, right? She's Deckard Cain, if you will, from the Diablo series. Her NPC class is different. Here I have her as a priest. Now, there are NPC stat blocks that exist in the various books, mostly in the Monster Manual.
Yeah.
And they're some of my favorite tools in the game. Just different types of people with jobs, essentially. So there's like a priest, there's a druid, there's the veteran, the thug, the mm-hmm. bandit, all those things. And it's nice to just have a stat block ready to go that maybe you adapt slightly for this character, right? Like, you might have Captain of the Guard. What is he? Well, he's a veteran, but with an extra 50 hit points, you know?
And maybe, like, one extra ability, able to, like, you know, do a version of inspiring speech or somewhat.
Yeah, something like that. Like, characters within 30 feet of him get, you know, plus 1d4 to stuff. Like, basically, they're under the effect of Bless.
Sure.
You know, something like that.
Because we got to bring Bless into everything.
So true. So, I like those. Also, if you're... there's no reason why your cast of characters can't include monsters. So, you know, the patron of your group could just be a beholder, like Xanathar, right? So, in that case,
that
I'll
would
have
be
a picture
fun.
Of Xanathar, and the NPC class will be beholder, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you use what you need. Then I have a section for voice. So I put Nordic, silly Swedish accent. This is just for me. Like, if you're a GM that likes to do a lot of different voices, it's nice to have a note there mm-hmm. that helps you.
I like to try voices because, I mean, I am a voice actor and I had taken the chance to expand my repertoire is always lovely. This is that part of it is one of the most important things for me because like one of the first things out of my mouth when someone comes back to an NPC that we haven't seen in a while is crap. What was their voice?
Yeah. And I fall into that all the time. And this is one reason why I really think having that picture helps.
Mm-hmm.
Because at least in my brain, the image of the character tells me a lot about what their voice should be.
Yeah.
And so, like, whenever I'm playing an NPC, I'm usually staring at their face. And that helps me kind of stay as consistent as I can. If they don't get a face and they end up just being a token,
mm-hmm.
I can lose track a little easier.
Yeah.
So there's that. I also write down personality, ideals, bond, flaw, just like you would for a player character. You want to have those there so that interacting with her feels rewarding. You want players to almost be able to like have their own tracking sheet and identify these things.
Sure.
About their about the character, so that way, if they use them, you know, you can grant them like advantage or disadvantage or whatever. This could also be a good way to bring inspiration points or reputation points if you're doing that in with the character. So you might even add another row here for like reputation points or something like that. For one of my campaigns, I actually have like on every NPC character sheet, I have a chart of the reputation that each individual member of the party has with them.
Oh my gosh, that seems like a lot to keep track of.
It is a lot to keep track of, and it's a lot to forget.
Mm-hmm.
But usually you kind of get used to, like, okay, this character is in good with this character. These two have, like, a bond of something. And then there's, like, various rewards you get from hitting various tiers, right? And not just, like, discounts or whatever, like, of course.
Sure.
But, like, this might unlock a quest, right? Or a secret, or give you an heirloom that happens to be a magic item, or granting you the use of a spell once a day. You know, kind of like what you see with like piety.
I like that a lot.
Yeah, it can be the same thing where it's like, especially since I have so many people that are at least vaguely familiar with Persona, they like feeling like they're building up those confidants.
Yeah, we are very... we're predictable, let's say.
And then finally, the last thing I have on here is just information that they have. Like, what is, you know, it's a version of the reward that you can get from interacting with them. But it's like, okay, if I click on this character and I go through the dialogue, what is the useful information I'm going to get? Not just like character banter faffing, but like, what is the actual, what's the meat I'm going to get from this?
Why are they here? They can, and you can have a few that are for flavor to like underline something about the world, but
even that's a purpose, right?
Even again, that is a purpose, yeah.
Even there, it's intent,
yeah.
Right now, and a reason why I think it's important to build up a cast beforehand is because you don't want to do what I do, which is make 5,000 freaking NPCs, and there's no way you're going to track all their voices, right?
Yeah.
Like, every idea that pops in your head doesn't need to be another NPC, right? Can we bring this back? How can Brunhilde fill this role?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Or how can I give this information to a player character as something that they would know and be able to convey to the rest of the group?
Even better. Absolutely. So I made 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Looks like I made about 7 characters here to create. When it comes to NPCs, you can be a little bit more generous. I think 7's a good number. 6, 7, 5, 8, something like that.
Yeah.
But keep it to a manageable number for you. But you can really have a lot of fun just building these guys and creating them beforehand. And make sure that, you know, even after you have this campaign done, that you're going back in and you're revisiting it to stay consistent, but also to make changes, right? Because, again, no plan survives first contact with the enemy, right? And same thing with players.
Yep, players are lightly the enemy on that one.
Yeah, and a lot of times my preparation doesn't make sense in the moment that it's about to be delivered, so I make changes on the fly. But it's important that I write down those changes.
Yep.
So that I remember that things happened, because not everyone gets to have a Tanya that records the session and then releases it, right? And we're very grateful. Thank you so much.
We very much are. Even if I go back and I went back and listened to one of those the other day and was like, I hate the sound of my voice because it's coming through the bad microphone on my laptop because I don't bother to set this up every time. So it's like,
a lot of work.
I know that I can sound better than that. Why do I sound like that?
Yeah, precisely. Okay, so Tiana, that is the end of the document. Well, as from the player perspective, because you have a lot of experience as a player, does this contain the things that you would want a GM to present? Are there any glaringly missing pieces for you?
I think the only thing that jumps out is something that I, as a player, would want to know about is any, like, this is also nitty gritty, but any notable objects.
Mm-hmm.
Anything like, you know, the Vaughn and Dodd, or like some magical sword that will light up in the presence of the king, or any like big quest specific objects, just to make sure that those can be kept track of. Like, where are they? Who has them? Do we have them? And can that, you know, tracking that sort of like nitty gritty detail.
No, I think that's an excellent idea. You could easily add a section here. Mm-hmm. That is like listed as like key items, right?
Yeah.
Because you can get to the point where you're like, okay, there's like 50 magic items that are floating around now, and I can't track it all. And now, because there's so many, they don't feel special anymore.
Yeah.
Right. And so, like, that's one thing in Baldur's Gate where I'm like getting rid of a blue item with a +2 enhancement bonus because it's not good enough anymore. Like, that's very sad.
Yeah. You feed it to Gale for snackies.
For snackies. I wish Gale would, like, buff from that or something.
Something. That, like, yeah, that's something that I would say to Larian is like, yeah, I understand this is to, like, help keep it under control. But also, like, have it be something other than, oh, we have to do this thing in order to keep him from going nuclear, literally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, they could, you know, depending on how strong, because I always give Gale my worst items, right?
Of course, like, obviously.
Here's like a piece of crap I'm never going to use. You know, if I give him something of a higher rarity, I should definitely get some kind of different payout, right?
I agree.
So that would be nice. And then that could actually make taking Gale more of a fun choice, as opposed to it, like, well, he is a wizard. Oh, man. Have you ever gone through the process of bringing him back to life without just the resurrection scroll?
No. I had him die once, and that was interesting because his dead body came back into camp and mm-hmm. wound up killing Scratch, which made me actually actively angry. I was like, look, dude, your influence and whatever with Mithra, fine. Or Mistra
yeah.
is fine. I was
but don't touch my dog.
Exactly. Like, leave the dog alone. The dog did nothing to you. And I know that it was because Scratch wandered into the circle of the radiating horrible. But I was like, why didn't we just leave his body there? I would have.
Yeah, they're like,
especially
plot
knowing
stuff.
That he was, especially knowing that he was gonna go nuclear. I was like, no, stay there. I'll come back.
Not going to lie, there have been a lot of playthroughs or playthrough attempts where I just leave him in the rock and I don't talk to him. Like, because I don't want to go through it. I don't want to go through his dialogue. It's boring. Like, I don't want to talk to him.
Which is unfortunate because he could be such a fun character, but there's something about him that I'm just like, why don't you click?
Yeah, no. And I know he does click for a lot of people, but I think in a lot of ways he feels like the generic necessity white guy.
Maybe.
And it's like, and then like his outfit's like not interesting. You know, everybody kind of looks cool.
Yeah.
Except for Gale. Gale looks like a more cleaned up version of like what a player character can be. But like even Alphira, who is made of the malleable parts, like you can literally recreate Alphira if you want to. She still looks more compelling and interesting than Gale does.
And I think you hit the nail on the head there, where it's like, this is generic white guy, and in other games that might not have stood out as much, like, he would have fit in perfectly fine with cleaned up graphics in, like, Dragon Age Origins or whatnot. But in the cast of characters that you can collect and have hanging out at your camp, he stands out so much as being, like, he's the token straight white guy.
You're right. He really is, and Shadowheart makes up for being white chick, because come on, no one even remembers that she's half elf. Like, She makes up for that by having interesting hair and like just tons of attitude. She has so much attitude.
Yeah.
And at least she gets like a like Sharin armor in the beginning of the game. It's like, why can't Gale have a nicer outfit? Like,
yeah,
just change his robe.
Also, though, I have stolen Minthar's camp clothes and my character is now wearing them. And yes, they're very nice.
Yeah, as you do. But yeah, I don't know. I think he's just a little bit, he's slightly lackluster.
Yeah.
Even, I mean, he's not a bad character, but he just, everybody else is just popping off so hard. Like, Karlach is just eating scenery, right?
I love Karlach so much.
She just dominates every scene she's in.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not an inch of her that doesn't ask a question visually, right? And then, of course, her attitude just adds to it. Gale's, like, passably funny, you know?
Yeah.
And Will's pretty boring, too, but then he becomes, like, a devil, and that's cool.
Right. And that happens really quickly when you bring him along on stuff. Like, and I guess that's the key for NPCs and whatnot is if they're going to be in-depth, make them interesting.
Yeah, 100%. Like, make sure that they're distinct and that they're not just filling orders, mm-hmm. right? Well, we have to have one of these and we have to have one of these. You know what? You don't want to have a blacksmith? Don't have a blacksmith.
Yeah.
Try not to have it. You don't want Deckard Cain? Figure out something different. It doesn't have to be some old guy. It doesn't have to be Gandalf every time, right? It can be a god if that is what you would prefer.
Yeah.
After all, your guys' patron was a god who was also a smith. And that made things so convenient.
It really did. Because then he could play with all the cool stuff that we were finding.
Yeah, he was your downtime activity guy. So that was cool. Okay. Yeah, so key items you might add. You know, if there's anything in here, of course, that speaks to you as a user, I would love to hear what your ideas are. This needs to be added or something. I'm not sure there's much here that I would take away.
I don't think there's anything in here that I would take away, really. There might be things that I use less because that flowchart right. doesn't work super well for the way my brain works. But it's right. good as like a touchstone to be like, right. Because, I mean, as a writer, I am a pantser, not a planner. But I am learning that I do best when it's like, okay, but here are the plot points that I need to hit.
Right, yeah. And so, but it's nice to have a visual representation of your outline some way.
Yeah. Whatever that is for you, however that works for your brain.
Absolutely. Delete my chart, but replace it with something.
Yeah.
Right? You know, put something there. Just make your own copy and let me know what you did with it. I would love to hear what people do with it and what they find is useful or not useful. And yeah, I guess that's really all I have to say on the matter. You're all ready to be great GMs now, right? Like, just do it, man. Like, you've been thinking about it. You've been mulling it around in your head. This is a good place to at least test to see whether or not this is something you truly want.
Mm-hmm.
What you'll regret, though, is just never exploring it.
Yeah.
If you don't have a campaign going on right now or even a group, but you're thinking you might want to do this someday, just write it. You know, there's no deadline. So just put down your ideas, and then at least that way you've got something succinct.
Yeah.
That's real in your brain.
And then you have something that you can present to a potential group to say, this is what I'm looking at doing. Is there any interest here?
Right. Because I can't finish it without players.
Yep.
So I guess that's about it on my end. Any last thoughts or are we about good?
I think the only thing that I would want to like say to wrap everything up is remember to focus in on your themes and remember to stay focused on your players. I don't like to give, you know, strict, never do this, always do this, but I will say always remember that your players are the main characters of the story and everything should be in service of those main characters. If it's not working, cut it out. If there's something that they bring to you where it's like, this is interesting to me, let them have it. Like, figure out how to work within your theme and work with your players to tell the story that you want to tell together, because that's going to be the most interesting for everyone. And that really is the essence, I think, of the secret ingredient.
Boom.
Where you are trading that love back and forth of they are getting to live an experience in this story and you're getting to give that to them. And you, this is beautiful back and forth between GM and players, in my slightly less than humble opinion.
No, I love that you said that. No notes. Perfect. Perfect ending.
Well, then I guess we should take it on home.
Go ahead.
It's easier when you don't make me laugh, you know.
Can't help it. I have a funny face.
I do laugh more now that I like can like see you. It makes it a lot easier.
So
thank
true.
You all so much for joining us for this week's episode of Inspiration Point. We hope that this three-episode compilation has been helpful for you to like think about what you want to do for campaigns, to figure out like how to tease out these ideas that you've been having and put them down in a more concrete form. We would love to hear about any campaign ideas that you put down. Come and join our Discord. Come and hang out in there. And yeah, thank you again so much for joining us. And until we meet again, stay inspired.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Inspiration Point. If you'd like to support what we do, go and check out our Patreon at patreon.com/inspirationpoint. If you can't support us directly, that's okay. You can also help support us by telling people about the podcast. A little inspiration goes a long way.
Inspiration Point is edited and produced by Tiana Hansen and is distributed by Quest and Chaos. If you like what you hear with us, give Quest and Chaos YouTube or Twitch channels a visit. They play Dungeons & Dragons on a weekly basis and have a bunch of campaigns of Call of Cthulhu, D&D, and board game playthroughs archived on their YouTube.
Join us next week for more inspiration.